4. The sixth extinction is canceled. 1. We're putting our own survival in danger. When the more than 6 million visitors enter the American Museum of Natural History in New York each year, they are greeted by an imagined prehistoric encounter between predator and prey, an enormous Barosaurus protecting its young from a menacing Allosaurus. There is also a more ominous message for visitors on a bronze plaque in the Theodore Roosevelt Rotunda, the museum's grand entrance hall. 5 major worldwide extinction events have struck biodiversity since the origin of complex animal life, some 535 million years ago, the plaque reads. Global climate changes and other causes, probably including collisions between the Earth and extraterrestrial objects, were responsible for the mass extinctions of the past. Right now, we are in the midst of the sixth extinction, this time caused solely by humanity's transformation of the ecological landscape. 1 million animal and plant species are at risk of becoming extinct because of humans, according to a 2019 report from something called the Intergovernmental Science Policy Platform on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services, IPBES. The rate of species extinction is already at least tens to hundreds of times higher than it has averaged over the past 10 million years, said the IPBES summary. Earth could lose 40% of all amphibians and 30% of marine mammals, 25% of mammals, and 20% of reptiles, IPBES warned. The 1,500-page report was prepared by 150 leading international experts on behalf of 50 governments. It was the most comprehensive review of the decline in biodiversity globally and the threat it poses to humans to date. The loss of species, ecosystems, and genetic diversity is already a global and generational threat to human well-being, said the IPBES chairman. The ultimate victims, many warn, will be us. Elizabeth Colbert, author of the 2014 book The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History, writes, by disrupting these systems, cutting down tropical rainforests, altering the composition of the atmosphere, acidifying the oceans, we're putting our own survival in danger, said the anthropologist Richard Leakey, co-author of the 1995 book The Sixth Extinction, Patterns of Life and the Future of Humankind. Homo sapiens might not only be the agent of the sixth extinction, but also risks being one of its victims. Claims that the extinction rate is accelerating and that 500,000 terrestrial species may already be doomed to extinction rest upon something called species area model. Conservation biologists Robert H. MacArthur and E.O. Wilson created the model in 1967. This model rests on the assumption that the number of new species that migrate to an island would decline over time. The idea was that as more species competed for declining resources, fewer would survive. Fortunately, the assumptions of the species area model proved to be wrong. In 2011, the British scientific journal Nature published an article titled Species Area Relationships Always Overestimate Extinction Rates from Habitat Loss. It showed that extinctions require greater loss of habitat than previously thought. Around the world, the biodiversity of islands has actually doubled on average, thanks to the migration of invasive species. The introduction of new plant species has outnumbered plant extinctions 100-fold. The invaders didn't crowd out natives, as Wilson and MacArthur feared. More new plant species have come into existence in Europe over the past 3 centuries than have been documented as becoming extinct over the same period, noted a British biologist. Colbert acknowledges the failure of the species area model. 25 years later, it's now generally agreed that Wilson's figures don't match observation, she writes. Colbert says the model's failure should be chastening to science writers, perhaps even more than to scientists. and yet it was not chastening enough for her to modify her book's title claim. In truth, nobody needed to know the model's fine workings to know it was wrong. If the species area model were true, then half of the world's species should have gone extinct during the last 200 years, notes an environmental scholar. 2. Exaggerating extinction. It turns out that IPPIS is not the principal scientific organization studying species, extinctions, and biodiversity. That status belongs to the International Union for Conservation of Nature, IUCN, and it says 6% are critically endangered, 9% are endangered, and 12% are vulnerable to becoming endangered. The IUCN has estimated that 0.8% of the 112,432 plant, animal, and insect species within its data have gone extinct since 1500. That's a rate of fewer than 2 species lost every year, for an annual extinction rate of 0.001%. The huge increase in biodiversity during the last 100 million years massively outweighs the species lost in past mass extinction. The number of genera, a measure of biodiversity more powerful than species count alone, has nearly tripled over the course of this time period. After each of these past 5 mass extinctions, the biodiversity in the fossil record dips between 15 to 20%, but each extinction is followed by much larger growth. Some say the erroneous claims of a 6th mass extinction undermine conservation efforts. To a certain extent, they're claiming it as a way of frightening people into action, when in fact, if it's actually true that we're in a 6th mass extinction, then there's no point in conservation biology, noted one scientist. People who claim we're in the 6th mass extinction don't understand enough about mass extinctions to understand the logical flaw in their argument. Conservationists, it turns out, are skilled at maintaining small populations of animals, from yellow-eyed penguins of New Zealand to mountain gorillas of Central Africa. The real challenge is expanding the size of their populations. It's not the case that humankind has failed to conserve habitat. By 2019, an area of Earth larger than the whole of Africa was protected, an area that is equivalent to 15% of Earth's land surface. The number of designated protected areas in the world has grown from 9,214 in 1962. To 102,102 in 2003, to 244,869 in 2020. The same is true in a part of Congo, Uganda, and Rwanda, known as the Albertine Rift. The area under protection there rose from 49% to 60% between 2000 and 2016. The real problem is not extinction, but rather the decline in animal populations and their overall habitat. The populations of wild mammal, bird, fish, reptile, and amphibian species declined by roughly half between 1970 and 2010. The worst impacts were in Latin America, which saw an 83% decline in wild animal populations, and in South and Southeast Asia, which saw a 67% decline. This reality has led some environmentalists to claim species are threatened by fossil fuels and economic growth. In 2014, the Oscar-nominated documentary film Virunga depicted the possibility of oil drilling in Virunga Park as a major threat to the mountain gorilla, and thus mountain gorilla tourism. But Virunga was misleading. The areas where the gorillas are have never had prospects of oil, primatologist Alistair McNeilage of Wildlife Conservation Society told me. McNeilage first went to Uganda in 1987 to study butterflies. The gorillas are on an escarpment, so there is no danger or desire of drilling or disturbing the area where the gorillas live, he said. And nobody makes that clear. A lot have fought oil companies in the name of the gorillas, but the oil companies just aren't interested in those areas. The real threat to the gorillas and other wildlife isn't economic growth and fossil fuels, I learned during my visit in December 2014, but rather poverty and wood fuels. In the Congo, wood and charcoal constitute more than 90% of residential primary energy. The place where gorillas are located, noted Caleb on our phone call, is near villages that need charcoal for cooking. Indeed, when Helen and I arrived at the lodge in Virunga Park, we could see from a distance the smoke from several fires burning inside the park. 3. Wood kills. Nobody knows for certain if Senkwekwe, a 500-pound silverback gorilla, smelled, heard, or saw the men who killed him and the four females in his group in July 2008. Even if Senkwekwe had, there was no reason he would have been alarmed. After all, he and the others in his 12-member family had been habituated to the smell of conservation biologists, park rangers, and tourists. Virunga Park rangers discovered their bodies the next day. The rangers quickly surmised that the killers were not seeking gorilla body parts. After all, they had not cut off their hands or heads. Nor were the men seeking gorilla babies for a foreign zoo. They found a traumatized infant gorilla left behind, cowering in the jungle. The gorillas appeared to have been assassinated by the mafia. It wasn't the first such killing. The month before, park rangers found a female gorilla who had been shot in the head with her infant, still alive, clinging to her breast. Another female gorilla went missing and was presumed dead. Men had killed 7 mountain gorillas in all. Local villagers carried the gorillas, including the giant silverbacks and Kwekwe, on a homespun stretcher. Some wept. A few months later, the director of Virunga Park was charged with taking bribes to turn a blind eye to charcoal production in the park. The killings appeared to be retaliation by the charcoal mafia after the park director, under pressure from European conservationists, stepped up efforts to stop charcoal production. People prefer charcoal for cooking because it is lighter, burns cleaner, and does not become infested like wood with insects. And charcoal is labor-saving. You can put a pot of beans onto a charcoal fire and go do something else. Unlike with a wood fire, you don't have to constantly blow on or fan the flames. Whole parts of Virunga Park had been taken over by the charcoal makers, who produce charcoal for the 2 million people in the city of Goma. To make charcoal, you slow-roast wood underground for 3 days. At the time of the gorilla killings, the charcoal trade was worth $30 million annually, while gorilla tourism brought in just $300,000. By the early 2000s, 25% of the old-growth, hardwood forest in the southern half of Virunga National Park had been lost to charcoal production. By 2016, the value of the charcoal trade had risen to $35 million annually. 90% of the wood harvested from the Congo Basin is used for fuel. Under a business-as-usual scenario, concluded researchers in 2013, charcoal supply could represent the single biggest threat to Congo Basin forests in the coming decades. Caleb agreed. The only place people have to get wood from is Virunga National Park, Caleb told me in 2014. In such a situation, you cannot expect the gorillas will remain safe. The Congolese government named Emmanuel Dumarode, the new director of Virunga Park, a few months after the charcoal mafia had killed Senkwekwe. Merode is a Belgian primatologist in his late 30s. He got the job by offering the Congolese government Division of Economic Development for communities around the park, financed by European governments and American philanthropist Howard Buffett, son of the legendary investor Warren Buffett. Merode's vision centered on building a small hydroelectric dam, schools, and a facility to make soap from palm oil. The European Union, Buffett Foundation, and other donors contributed more than $40 million to Merod's efforts between 2010 and 2015. "What Emmanuel is doing is impressive and admirable," said Michael Cavanaugh, who lived in and has reported on the Congo for years. "A 4-megawatt dam doesn't sound like much, but for this world, it's huge. Emmanuel will always say that what we're doing now in Congo is harvesting palm oil and sending it to Uganda to process and ship back, and that's insane. If Congo had power, it could build those factories and provide those jobs. One of the benefits of the dam was that it would reduce the government's economic incentive to drill for oil in Virunga Park. Congo is run by a small group of elites," said Cavanaugh. "And if you can incentivize them to not explore oil, then it would be possible for them not to." One day, Caleb and I visited the hydroelectric dam under construction near the town of Matebi. We met the 29-year-old Spanish engineer, Daniel, who was overseeing the dam construction. Caleb became boyish in his enthusiasm. "Once this project is built," Caleb said, "Buffett will be like Jesus." As we walked from Daniel's office to the dam, Caleb held Daniel's hand, which is something Congolese men do when they are friends. I asked Daniel if he was married. "Yes, to my work," he laughed. "This construction is my wife and mistress and children." Daniel said that he was bringing the project in on time and within budget. The people we interviewed around Virunga Park knew about Merod's plans to build a dam and were excited to get electricity, which they said they would use for lighting, cell phone charging, ironing, and electric stoves. And yet the threat of violence remained ever present, including when Helen and I visited in 2014. Earlier that year, Merod had left the courthouse in Goma and was driving back to Virunga Park in his Land Rover. He was all alone except for the AK-47 at his side. About halfway to park headquarters, Merod turned a corner and saw a gunman 200 meters away. As I approached, I saw him raise his rifle, and I saw two other men crouched in the forest, Merod told the reporter. At that point, the bullets started hitting the vehicle, so I ducked. Merod was hit, as was the engine or circuit board of his Land Rover, which stalled. Merod grabbed his AK-47 and tumbled out the door. Once in the bushes, he started firing wildly. After the would-be assassins were out of sight, Merod stumbled onto the road and waved for help. Despite his being covered in blood, aid agency cars sped past him. Two farmers on a motorcycle finally stopped, chucked their crops to the side, and strapped him to the back. The really painful part was being carried on the back of the motorbike on the Congolese roads, which are extremely bumpy, Merod recalled. The farmers took him to an army checkpoint and loaded him onto a truck. But then the truck ran out of gas. I had to reach into my pocket and give them $20, said Merod, which was covered in blood. Then the truck broke down. He was transferred to another army vehicle, which took him to a park vehicle. Finally, he arrived at the hospital. The 44-year-old Merod had emergency surgery and somehow survived. All of which raises a question. Why, if Merod was doing so much for the people around Virunga Park, had somebody tried to kill him? 4. Colonial Conservation. In 470 BCE, Hanno the navigator, an explorer from Carthage, the North African city near modern-day Tunisia in North Africa, mistook a group of guerrillas for humans. In the foothills of the mountains of what is today Sierra Leone, Hanno's local guides led him to an island in the middle of a lake, inhabited by a rude description of people, wrote Hanno. The females were much more numerous than the males and had rough skins. Our interpreters called them gorillae. Hanno decided he needed some as specimens, and so he and his men gave chase. We pursued but could take none of the males. They all escaped to the top of precipices, which they mounted with ease, and threw down stones. We took 3 of the females, but they made such violent struggles, biting and tearing their captors, that we killed them and stripped off the skins, which we carried to Carthage. Being out of provisions, we could go no further. Hanno's fellow Carthaginians must have been as fascinated by the creatures as he was, because when the Romans invaded Carthage 300 years later, the skins were still on display. Fascination with mountain gorillas grew among European colonizers in the 19th and 20th centuries. The mountain gorillas of Central Africa got their species name, Gorilla Gorilla Barenghi, from a German officer who killed two of them in 1902. In 1921, a Swedish prince killed 14 mountain gorillas. Between 1922 and 1924, an American killed and captured 9. Throughout the next 25 years, hunters killed about 2 gorillas annually, ostensibly for scientific research. A turning point came when a naturalist working for the American Museum of Natural History killed 5 gorillas in 1921 and was consumed with regret. As he lay at the base of the tree, wrote Carl Akeley, "It took all of one's scientific ardor to keep from feeling like a murderer. He was a magnificent creature with the face of an amiable giant who would do no harm except perhaps in self-defense or in defense of his friends." Akeley traveled to Belgium and met with King Albert. Coincidentally, the king had been to the newly opened Yellowstone National Park in the United States and was inspired by Akeley to protect the gorillas by giving them their own park. He called it Virunga National Park. But the hunting didn't stop. Zoos in Europe, the United States, and other nations wanted gorillas to display to their publics. But Akeley was right about gorillas. They give their lives to defend children and family members. In 1948 alone, 60 gorillas were killed trying to prevent 11 of their infants from being taken for sale to foreign zoos. Even though it was foreigners, not local people, who killed mountain gorillas, European colonizers sought to expel the locals from the areas they had designated for parks. American conservationists, including Sierra Club founder John Muir, successfully advocated for governments to evict indigenous people from Yellowstone and Yosemite Park in the 1860s and 1890s. King Albert of Belgium brought that same model to the eponymously named Albertine Rift, where many people already lived and, indeed, humankind was born 200,000 years ago. The Albertine Rift is spectacularly beautiful and biodiverse, with forests, volcanoes, swamps, erosion valleys, and mountains with glaciers. It is home to 1,757 terrestrial vertebrate species, half of all of Africa's birds, and 40% of its mammals. Mountain gorillas today can be found in Rwanda's Volcanoes National Park, Congo's Virunga Park, and Uganda's Bwindi Impenetrable National Park. But creating those parks involved the eviction of local communities, which has led to disputes and violence. Virunga Park was created during colonial times, noted Helga Rayner, a conservationist with the Great Ape Program. Land is the resource at the heart of the conflict, and it was European colonialists who changed or confused land tenure systems. Scientists estimate that between 5 and 10s of millions of people have been displaced from their homes by conservationists since the creation of Yosemite National Park in California in 1864. A Cornell University sociologist estimated that Europeans created at least 14 million conservation refugees in Africa alone. Displacing people from their lands wasn't incidental to conservation, but rather central to it. The displacement of people who herded, gathered forest products, or cultivated land was a central feature of 20th century nature conservation in southern and eastern Africa and India, noted two scholars. The Ugandan government and conservationists expelled the Batwa from Uganda's Bwindi Park in the early 1990s. Their poaching of wild animals for meat threatened the gorillas, conservationists believed. Whole societies like the Batwa of Uganda writes Mark Dowie, the author of the 2009 book Conservation Refugees, have been transformed from independent and self-sustaining to deeply dependent and poor communities. Conservation refugees can suffer from very high stress and poor health. Scientists took saliva samples from 8,000 indigenous people in India who had been evicted from their villages by the government to create a lion sanctuary. The scientists discovered that the people suffered from shortened telomeres, a sign of premature aging from stress, despite having been compensated and given new homes. Something similar happened to Uganda's Batwa. Since they had depended on harvesting meat, honey, and fruit from within Bwindi Park for centuries, they did not know how to create a new life as farmers. Consequently, noted researchers 10 years later, the other community members have taken advantage of the Batwa's deprivation to exploit them. On my return to the United States from the Congo, I interviewed Francine Madden, a conservationist who worked to reduce human-wildlife conflicts in Uganda in the early 2000s. I told her about how the baboons had eaten Bernadette's sweet potatoes and about the widespread complaints I had heard of crop raiding. People go to parks asking for compensation for their animals coming out and destroying their crops, said Madden, which in many ways is quite reasonable. If your neighbor's cows came and ate your crops, you'd want to be compensated. But few parks can set up compensation systems that are manageable. Other conservationists agreed that crop raiding was a major problem. In Uganda, crop raiding was one of the biggest issues conservationists had to deal with, McNeilage said, and was the biggest source of conflict with community, along with access to resources of one kind or another. So it's not surprising that that's what people were telling you. In 2004, researchers with Wildlife Conservation Society found that 2/3 of the people they surveyed around Virunga Park reported having their crops eaten by baboons once a week. Significant percentages reported crop raiding by gorillas, elephants, and buffalo. Another primatologist, Sarah Sawyer, studied gorillas both in Uganda and in Cameroon, which, like Congo, was too poor to benefit from ecotourism. The idea of conservation that local people in Cameroon held was that you get kicked off your land and you get no money. While I got used to being called white man, both in Cameroon and other countries, at my field site we were called conservation, instead in a very derogatory way, and it hurt. We don't want conservation here, they would say. Talking about conservation there felt totally wrong, because the local people felt like conservation was simply a way to rob them of their resources. Talking to them about conserving gorillas was not talking to them in their own language. This reminded me of what I had read in grad school about conservation as neo-colonialism. 5. Fighting the locals is a losing battle. By the 1990s, it appeared most conservationists had internalized the lesson that fighting the locals is a losing battle. Conservation non-governmental organizations, NGOs, made strong statements declaring their support for protecting local people. They worked to improve their treatment of the people who live in or near protected areas. International development agencies like the United States Agency for International Development, USAID, have spent millions seeking to protect impacted indigenous people and others living near parks and protected areas. In 1999, the International Union for Conservation of Nature, IUCN, officially recognized indigenous people's right to the sustainable traditional use of their land. In 2003, the World Parks Congress passed a Do No Harm principle and promised to financially compensate poor and developing nations protecting natural and wild areas like Virunga. In 2007, the United Nations approved a strong statement of support for indigenous rights impacted by conservation efforts. Today, Conservationists point to efforts by NGOs to promote alternatives to charcoal and to the success of guerrilla tourism as proof that conservation can pay for itself and reduce pressure on habitats. But, says primatologist Sawyer, there are few species like the mountain gorilla that relatively wealthy foreigners will spend thousands of dollars to see. In Rwanda today, it costs $1,500 to view gorillas for 1 hour. And even with those species, the ecotourism opportunity is lost when there is no infrastructure, security, and economic development. Wildlife Conservation Society's Andrew Plumtree and his colleagues conducted interviews with people representing 3,907 households around Albertine Rift parks in the early 2000s and found that few benefited from tourism. When people were asked about the benefits of the forest for themselves or their communities, tourism ranked very low, they wrote. Tourism was only perceived as being useful to the country as a whole. Meanwhile, NGO efforts to promote alternatives to charcoal, such as through wood pellets and special stoves, have failed. The pellets haven't been a great success anywhere, said McNeilage. I don't know anywhere where they've cottoned on and become popular. Plumtree agreed. The World Wildlife Fund has long had a program of planting trees for sustainable use, but it has not had a great impact on the push for charcoal out of the park, he told me. The reason is that the locals used the plantation to make more lucrative poles for building, rather than wood fuel to use as charcoal. The need to move to modern fuels is a bone of contention of mine, said Dr. Helga Rayner of the Great Ape Program. That we still talk about energy-saving stoves is disappointing. The situation is increasingly desperate. In Plumtree's study of the people around Virunga Park, he and his colleagues found that half reported not having sufficient access to firewood. The experience of working in places where conservationists aren't welcome made conservation scientist Sawyer question whether her efforts were worth it. When I first got in conservation biology, I thought, find the most vulnerable areas and protect them, she said. Now I see that it might not be a lost cause, but in many places, conservation is the last priority. You have to be careful what situations you try to conserve. The places where you can get the biggest bang for the buck aren't always the places where things work. I thought, you can't lose species from the planet, but then you have to ask, is it worth saving this species at the cost of the social, political, and economic cost on the human side? Or do we say, we hope the species makes it, but there are other priorities in this area right now? Plumtree worries that the management of Virunga Park by foreigners will weaken local support. My problem is when it's seen as outsiders coming in and taking care of everything, you are at risk of the park being seen as an expat's playground. And so when threats come, there may be little support for them. Merode, the Virunga National Park director, is himself a Belgian prince who married into conservation royalty. His wife, Louise, is the daughter of Richard Leakey, who warned of a sixth extinction, and granddaughter of Louis Leakey, the primatologist who uncovered humankind's evolutionary origins in the Albertine Rift. Merode's first major act upon becoming director was to crack down on the small farmers planting within Virunga Park. Recall that, due to a lack of fertilizer, roads, and irrigation, people in the area are desperate for land. He reduced the ranger force from 650 to 150, and then tried to go to war with people at gunpoint and force them out, Plumtree said. Merode's hard line surprised the conservation community. He did his whole PhD on community conservation, and so it was quite a shock to us when he militarized and forced people out of the park at gunpoint, said Plumtree. Historically, he had worked with communities. Merode's crackdown backfired. They ended up with many more people in the park afterwards, Plumtree said. That was a big mistake. The idea was to use the same funds to pay a higher salary, but but they took the number of park rangers down to such a low number that they couldn't control the park. Madden, the scientist who studied crop raiding, said aggressive approaches to conservation had, in the past, resulted in local people killing wildlife. If people don't feel respected and recognized, they will retaliate, and may retaliate in a disproportionate way, she said. Journalists and scientists have documented such behavior for decades. Plumtree said the animosity Meroud created among local residents may have resulted in the deaths of as many as 250 elephants. We did a census and found just 35 elephants left in Virunga Park, down from 300 elephants in 2010, Plumtree said. Some may have moved to Queen Elizabeth Park in Uganda, but we haven't seen 240 or 250 new elephants in Uganda, and we did surveys on both sides of the border. It's impossible for a person to retaliate against the government, Madden said, but you can retaliate against the wildlife that the government is trying to protect. It is a symbolic retaliation. It's a screw-you psychological retaliation. I asked Plumtree why Meroud had opted for such a heavy hand against locals. He felt there were a lot of people living in the park who shouldn't be there, and one of the things he had to do was try to stamp control in the park, he said. I think he didn't realize how much he needed the support of the local traditional chiefs. They were involved in illegal activities, and he probably thought if he could get away with not having to deal with them, that would be much easier. Madden believes that the personality of many conservation scientists undermines their relationship with locals. Conservation scientists are highly introverted and analytical, she said. They want to make big decisions by themselves in a corner with people who think like them, and then give it to people who experience it as an imposition. It's not like they try to be assholes. They want to get it right. They don't have the same values, and it looks disrespectful and blows up. Between 2015 and 2019, crop raiding by Virunga Park animals had worsened. In late 2019, a local farmer told Caleb, "We need the park to protect our farms by building the electric fence to prevent animals from coming to raid our crops. The park has to take responsibility to keep the animals out of their farms," said Madden. "There was a full-scale insurrection against the crop raiding when I was there. Gorillas were getting killed and sent over to Congo for barbecue. People were getting hurt, with half of their thigh ripped out. It was on the verge of anarchy. Cameroon, too, stands as a warning to Congo that things can go from bad to worse," says primatologist Sarah Sawyer. "When I arrived at the reserve in Cameroon, it was being discussed as deserving extra protection," she said. "When I left, it was being discussed as a potential logging concession." Anyone exposed to books like The Sixth Extinction, reports like IPPIS's 2019 platform, and films like Virunga, along with the publicity they generate, might reasonably think that protecting wildlife requires restricting economic growth, strictly enforcing park boundaries, and fighting oil companies. Worse, they might give developed world audiences the impression that African wildlife parks are best run by Europeans. "When Virunga Park was run by the Congolese," said Plumtree, "there were more large mammals, less political problems, and fewer people invading the park, even though they didn't have anywhere near the money coming in. Today, there's infrastructure, but the mammal numbers have crashed, and there is a lot of cultivation in the park that wasn't there 5 or 6 years ago." 6. The 800-pound gorilla. In 2018, Virunga Park closed after an armed group murdered a 25-year-old park ranger and kidnapped three people, two of whom were British tourists. The kidnappers released the tourists and their Congolese driver 2 days later. The victim was one of only 26 female rangers working at the park at the time. After closing for 8 months, Virunga Park reopened to tourists in early 2019, but only a few weeks later, a local armed group killed another park ranger. As for Bernadette, armed men appeared with the apparent intention to kidnap or kill her husband and they were forced to flee. I found this out after I hired Caleb in late 2019 to do a follow-up interview with her. After some searching, Caleb was able to track her down. They met in person, and Bernadette told him that her husband had been targeted for political reasons. "My husband is the grandson to the chief," she said, "whom bandits took into the bush and killed. His son took over, but the bandits killed him, too. The brother to the older assassinated chief took over, but the bandits killed him, too. The next in the line of succession fled to Goma. It was then that the bandits came for Bernadette's husband. We awoke to people trying to break in. My husband was scared, and I was still deep asleep. He got up slowly and went to our daughter's room. I awoke and called out to him, 'Jackson's dad! Jackson's dad!' Nobody answered. I grew scared. Then I heard them trying to open the door, and I said to myself, 'There is another woman who died at the place of her husband when he was being hunted. I may also get shot in the head.' And so I got up slowly and took my baby, who began crying. They heard how I was moving in my daughter's bedroom. I found my husband standing there. I stood up next to him. I don't know why, but God inspired him to take the telephone and check what time it was. When they heard the phone ringing, they were afraid and left the door. They left the front door and went behind the house, and we heard them calling each other. We stayed quiet, no shouting. We stayed sitting the whole night, until morning, because we were still afraid. 3 days later, we awoke to the guys again trying to force open the door. We got up and went to stand up in our daughter's bedroom because we thought they might shoot. My husband took out his telephone and started pretending to be talking to somebody, and we heard them leave. The next day, Bernadette's mother-in-law urged them to flee. My husband said, 'No, my father has passed away. How am I going to leave you alone?' 'Who am I going to leave you with?' his mother said. 'We have picked up too much of your brother's brains already, and that is enough. Just go. God will take care of me.'" Bernadette left 7 of their children with her mother-in-law, and she and her husband and 3 children went to work on other people's farms. When Caleb interviewed her, Bernadette sounded depressed. "In order to survive here, you have to work for someone," she told Caleb. "You have to clear or cultivate to get food to eat. I'm suffering with life. We are not overcoming." When I asked Caleb what could happen to Bernadette if she were kidnapped, Caleb replied, "When they kidnap the women, they also rape them. The men, they beat. They call your relatives and put you on speakerphone so your family can hear you being tortured." "But how could such poor people possibly afford to pay a ransom?" He said it was by selling their land and borrowing from relatives. 7. Why Congo Needs Fossil Fuels. Ultimately, for people to stop using wood and charcoal as fuel, they will need access to liquefied petroleum gas, LPG, which is made from oil and cheap electricity. Researchers in India proved that subsidizing rural villagers in the Himalayas with LPG reduced deforestation and allowed the forest ecosystem to recover. Some conservationists, including the Wildlife Conservation Society's McNeilage, believe it is inevitable that the Congolese government will one day drill for oil in Virunga National Park and that the results could be positive. "I think the chances they'll leave the oil underground indefinitely is pretty minimal. The oil price has gone way down, and maybe that's why they're not moving as fast as they were in Uganda. The estimates were of 2 to 3 billion barrels. Not all of them would be recoverable, but there could be 30,000 to 60,000 barrels per day, and even 250,000 barrels per day. It could make a big difference to regional fuel needs." McNeilage's colleague, Plumtree, agrees. "If they had hydro and oil, and if it can be done in a clean way to generate electricity and gas to use instead of charcoal, that would be good for the environment." McNeilage recognizes that his point of view remains controversial among conservationists. "There's 2 lines of thought," he said. "One is that it is illegal. It's a United Nations World Heritage Site. In an ideal world, doing what we can to stop it is the right thing to do. The other line of thought and this is me going out on my own, is that if it goes ahead anyway, it would be better that British Petroleum or the most responsible oil company do the best job they can with the minimum impact and maximum benefit for local people and transparency and the rest of it. If you succeed in scaring away SOCO, a London-based oil company that sought to drill inside Virunga Park, does that mean a worst-case scenario will come along and you'll have, I don't know what, a company from Asia somewhere? A less responsible company takes the oil out and doesn't give two hoots what the world thinks. I think often you get someone worse who cares less about the danger. McNeilage had helped the French oil company Total S.A. drill sustainably for oil in Uganda's Murchison Falls National Park, northeast of Virunga Park, a major park in the Albertine Rift. I've always come from a background of wanting to build the capacity for the countries I'm working in to do this work themselves and understand the importance of it, he said. That's fundamentally the right approach. McNeilage's motivation to work with the oil companies is based on a mix of realism and humanism. I realized that we were in crisis in many ways more than I thought we were. The oil industry has the potential, and the scale of the income is more than enough to pay for the upkeep of the park. Potentially, they can generate a lot of income if the oil companies involved are committed to protecting the areas they are exploiting. If they do it right, it can do good for publicity, but also harm for publicity if they make a mess somewhere. Oil drilling has occurred with surprisingly little impact. You can find a level of disturbance, McNeilage says. Animals will tend to move away from the immediate area of any areas of operations, but it's not a large disturbance at the level of the park as a whole if the company takes precautions to minimize impact, and there is a lot they have been able to do to keep impact to a minimum. The impacts we saw on animals would have been transitory. That said, McNeilage says it hasn't been easy. The actual practicalities of getting the companies to do what they need has been difficult. It has been frustrating to work with Total because it's a huge bureaucracy, and it was sometimes hard to get them to do things that they should have done. I asked McNeilage how the experience has changed him since he first arrived in the Congo more than a quarter century earlier to study butterflies. I don't think I'm a fundamentally different person, he said, just a lot less naive. 8. Power for Progress. As for the Virunga Dam, built by Merod with Howard Buffett and EU money, most experts believe it cannot be easily scaled up. That project is not a sustainable project and can't be copied throughout the country, said Kavanaugh, the reporter. You have a wealthy donor putting up the money. You have a particular situation because of the guerrillas and the park and because of Emmanuel. Virunga is practically a fiefdom of ICCN, run by Emmanuel. They can get around the things the average company can't get around. Eventually, the dam will provide electricity to 20,000 people, but that is a drop in the bucket when considering that there are 2 million people in Goma alone. And the high cost of electricity from the Virunga Park Dam means that only the relatively wealthy have been able to afford it. The upfront cost of $292 to connect to the grid is prohibitive for most. Recall that the average annual income is $561. It's helping people open factories, garages, and grinding machines, but lower-class people can't afford it, one man told Caleb. And so it's not stopping the exploitation of the park for charcoal. It's still coming out of the park. The objective was to stop the cutting of trees in the park for making charcoal, but now the electricity is very expensive. As long as it is, people will continue making charcoal from trees within the park. Experts agree that the easiest and cheapest way for Congo to produce abundant supplies of cheap electricity is by building the long-planned Grand Inga Dam on the Congo River. You have 100,000 megawatt potential through Inga, Kavanaugh said. You can provide all of Africa with that power. The Inga would be 50 times larger than the Hoover Dam, which serves 8 million people in California, Arizona, and Nevada. but for cheap electricity and LPG to pay for themselves and not depend on charitable donations from European governments and American philanthropists. The Congo needs security, peace, and industrialization of the kind that has lifted so many nations out of poverty in the past.